This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 16th, 2015. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, we have David Grimm up first with some online news stories, and then we hear from Charles Bishop about the altitude-defying migrations of the geese that fly over the Himalayas. He spoke with Suzanne Bard, who'll be filling in for me over the coming months during my maternity leave.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people.
Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on how our immune systems are shaped over time. Let me just start out by saying, and I think I've actually said this before, I love twin studies. They really solve so many problems. In this case, researchers used identical and fraternal twins to look at the role of genetics in the immune system. What kind of questions were they asking, Dave?
Well, Sarah, they were trying to figure out what it is that actually shapes our immune systems. Our immune systems are incredibly complicated. They have all these different components, different types of cells, different types of proteins. And though everybody sort of has the same basic contingent of this immune army, every soldier between persons is a little bit different. You know, some people have some cells that are better at something or proteins that work a little bit differently. And the question is, what causes this variation between immune systems? Is it purely genetics, or does our environment play a large role as well?
And so twins are special because they have identical genomes.
Right.
Identical twins have identical genomes. So they were looking at a bunch of different components. Can you talk about what parameters they measured and what they found out about the genes versus environment debate here?
Yeah, well, they were looking at about 200 different components of the immune system, things like the kinds of immune cells, the kinds of proteins that are used by these cells. And what they found comparing all these twins was that environment seemed to play a much larger role than genetics in shaping these immune systems. For example, as identical twins got older, their immune systems really started to diverge, which means that genes really aren't playing a large role there, that these twins, as they get older and they're exposed to different environments, that it really seems to be the environment that's shaping their immune system.
And when we talk about environment, what exactly are we talking about? What kinds of things had large impacts on the immune system of these twins?
Well, when we talk about environment, especially concerns the immune system, we're talking about things like your exposure to pathogens, even your exposure to vaccines. And indeed, one of the tests the researchers ran is they looked at twins that had gotten flu vaccines, and they found that the response in terms of the antibodies that these individuals produced actually varied between twins, which suggests, again, that it's a component of environment. Maybe one twin had been exposed to other vaccines, other pathogens, than the other twin had. So that was a really strong evidence for environment. They also looked at something called cytomegalovirus, which is a virus a lot of us have. It doesn't always cause problems. In fact, it can stay dormant for a long periods of time in our bodies. But they again found that pairs of identical twins with a different infection status, in other words, some that had the cytomegalovirus and some that didn't, had a much more divergent immune system than sets of twins that were both uninfected, again suggesting that there are some differences between people that are really explained much more by environment than by genetics.
Is this really a surprising finding, considering that our immune systems are designed or responsible for responding to the environment, recording our history, and mounting a response if we encounter something again.
Yeah, in a way, it's not surprising because our immune systems, the reason they're so effective is because they're so adaptable. They have to be able to respond very quickly and powerfully to changes in our environment. And if all of our immune systems were sort of hardwired to be the same from birth, we'd have a really hard time adapting to new insults. So in a way, it's not surprising, but before this study, it had really been hard to show just really what are the different contributions of environment versus genetics.
Next up, we have a story on migrating monarchs. When the U.S. public heard that monarch butterflies were in danger, that their food supply along their migration route to Mexico was dwindling, they stepped in to save the day, planting milkweed and helping count the migrating insects. But now it appears that there's a problem with the efforts of these helpful gardeners. What seems to be the trouble, Dave?
Well, it appears that some of this help may have backfired. Researchers know that the number of monarchs migrating from the U.S. to Mexico every year has been dwindling for quite some time. There were two reasons for this. One problem was on the Mexico side because Mexico had been deforesting a lot of the habitat that these butterflies relied on. So Mexico has tried to curb that. But another problem was on the U.S. side. Monarchs lay their eggs in milkweed plants. But what had been happening is a lot of farmers had been spraying their crops, and there's a lot of milkweed interspersed with these crops, with pesticides that had been killing the milkweed. So the monarchs in the U.S. didn't have anywhere to lay their eggs, and so a lot of them were dying.
And when gardeners or people who care about insects started to try to help out by planting their own milkweed, it did not turn things around the way it was expecting.
No, and the reason seems to be is that they were planting the wrong species of milkweed. They were planting a tropical species, which actually the monarchs really loved because tropical species sticks around all year, doesn't die off in the winter. The problem is if the plant that the monarchs rely on doesn't die off in the winter, they have no reason to migrate to Mexico. The other big problem is actually a parasite that grows in milkweed. And if the milkweed doesn't die off, the monarchs tend to hold onto this parasite, keep transmitting it to other monarchs, and that is killing off a lot of monarchs as well, or at least researchers thought.
So to look into this more deeply, researchers again recruited the public to help. What did they do in this case?
Well, they were asking people to take pieces of transparent tape and basically stick it to the monarchs' abdomens, peel it off, and look for evidence of this parasite. It's called Ophrocystis electrocheiron. I'm pretty sure I mispronounced that, but let's just say OE for short. And what the study revealed is that there was a ton of OE infection in monarch butterflies. In fact, there were some breeding sites where 100% of monarchs were infected with this parasite.
Now, can those who still want to help the monarch butterfly do anything at this point to resuscitate their migration?
Well, a couple things. They can destroy some of the milkweed in the winter, so the monarchs have an excuse to migrate and may not transmit this parasite as well. Or they could try planting the correct species of milkweed that the monarchs need.
Lastly, we have a story on the mystery of when human language first arose. Timing the origin of language is incredibly difficult. As the writer of this next story puts it, words leave no traces in the archaeological record. So Dave, what are some of the ways that have been tried to figure out when this important human trait first came about?
Well, researchers suspect language evolved sometime between 50,000 years ago and 2 million years ago. That's a pretty broad range. And so traditionally, researchers have looked at sort of these proxy phenomena like tool making or creation of art, the idea being that you must have language to make tools and to create art, or at least maybe these things sort of evolved around the same time. But these are really indirect measurements, and scientists are trying to get a sense of, at least in this new study, can we really use tool making itself as a proxy for the development of language?
And so the study takes a pretty novel approach. They actually have students making their own stone tools the same way our ancestors did 2.5 million years ago. Can you describe the setup? How do they teach these students and what do they do?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the tools first. These tools are called Oldowan tools, and that's named after a site that's very famous for a lot of these tools being found. These are very simple tools. You can actually see a picture of them on the site. These basically look like, in some cases, sharpened pieces of rock, and the way that they're created is you sort of hit one stone core with another stone that's sort of the hammer in such a way that you create this really sharp flake on one of the stones that you can use to butcher animals, to cut meat, things like that. Seems simple, but these are actually fairly complicated to learn how to make these types of tools.
We have these different groups of students learning from their masters. We have a master that just says nothing and breaks off a flake. We have a master that uses gesture. And we have a master that uses language. What were some of the differences between these groups?
Well, what they did was they didn't just figure out how well these students learned from the masters, but how well they could pass that knowledge on to future students. And they wanted to see transmission over several, quote-unquote, generations. And what they found is that when the students did not use language, they had a really hard time creating effective stone tools. But those that had used either gestures or language were much better at creating more effective stone tools.
So this sounds like, yes, it would be easier to learn toolmaking and share such a vital skill by using language and gesture, maybe timing language acquisition to this 2.5 million year ago time period. But not everyone is on board with the way the researchers are interpreting this research. Can you talk about some of the objections out there?
Well, one of the big problems is that even though these students really knew nothing about making stone tools, they knew a lot about language. They had been living their entire lives using language. So they were very facile at using gestures and especially using the spoken word, which is not an advantage our ancestors would have had. So some critics say that the problem with the study is it really sort of oversimplifies what may have really been present in our ancestors 1 million, 2 million years ago. The other problem is the students really were not given that much time to create these stone tools. They were only given 5 minutes to learn the tool-making techniques and 25 minutes to apply them. My guess is that our ancestors probably had a lot more time to do that. So that is another potential issue with the study.
What else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about why women are underrepresented in quote-unquote genius areas of work. Also a story about whether earthquakes are really earth burps. And for our policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about critics claiming that Republicans in U.S. Congress are trying to silence scientific evidence. Also a story about the National Institutes of Health cracking down on scientists they think are getting too much grant money. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Next, we have Suzanne Bard, who's going to tell us about the amazing journeys of bar-headed geese.
Climbers who summit Mount Everest may have nothing on bar-headed geese, who regularly fly over the Himalayas during their biannual migrations without carrying any fancy equipment at all. To find out how they make these low-oxygen flights, Charles Bishop outfitted the geese with custom-designed instruments to measure their physiology and flight mechanics at altitude. In a report this week, he finds that the geese save energy during these flights by employing a counterintuitive roller coaster-style flight strategy.
We've been able to study one of the great high-altitude migrants, the bar-headed goose, which is an animal that breeds in Central Asia, in places like northern China and in Mongolia, and then has to migrate southwards through the Tibetan Plateau and up over the Himalayas to reach India, or a large number of them choose to overwinter. And this means that they have to fly at least 4,500 meters in order to reach their destination. And one of the expectations was that the birds would have to climb high as they entered into the mountains for an hour or two, get up to an altitude where they wanted to then continue on horizontally, and then after a few hours that would be enough for the day and then they would land. What we actually discovered was that instead these birds are regularly going up and then down again and then up and then down again within the same flight. And we called this the roller coaster strategy because they don't stay at a steady altitude but continually shed the hard-won altitude or height that they've just gained earlier in the flight. And this was kind of unexpected.
So are there no easier routes or alternative ways to get from one place to the other? I mean, why do they have to make this difficult journey?
Well, in fact, the Himalayas is so broad and crosses over the whole of the top of the Indian subcontinent that actually if you're in western and central Mongolia or if you're in northern China, if you want to go due south, you will have to cross Tibet and the Himalayas. You could fly a more easterly route. And some birds seem to do that. But you must remember that migrant birds often learn the routes. It's historical over many generations, and the young birds learn the migration strategy from the adults. And interestingly enough, birds have been around for about 40, 50 million years, and the Himalayas is about the same age. It's about 55 million years ago that the Indian tectonic plate smashed into the Eurasian plate. So the Himalayas have grown up over the last 50 million years as the ancestors of geese also developed. So at one time it would have been very easy to travel that route north and south. And then as the mountains got higher and higher, the birds will have co-evolved with the mountains to learn how to fly high and to continue on their traditional migratory routes.
Well, that's a really fascinating thing to think about, a co-evolution as mountains are rising.
That's exactly it, yes.
Interesting. So how do bar-headed geese compare in terms of altitude and distance with other champion migratory birds around the world? What's their competition for the title of world's highest flyer?
First of all, what do we mean by flight? So some birds can soar on thermals and hardly flap their wings at all and go very, very high indeed with very little cost. So the highest kind of reliable sightings of birds are the Ripoll's griffon vulture, which unfortunately crashed into an aircraft at 11,300 meters. From my research point of view, I'm really interested in birds that provide their own lift and their own power from their own muscle. Of the 9,000 species of birds in the world, the vast majority never go above 1,000 meters. But the bar-headed goose has to go to a minimum of around about 5,000 meters in order to complete its migration every year. So certainly the barhead holds the title of the most regular high-flying bird, in my view.
It makes sense that they should get a little bit more credit than a vulture because they're actually doing all the work.
Exactly. I think the vulture is really kind of almost asleep up there.
I would imagine that measuring the energetics of bird flight at any altitude is hard to do. So how do you go about it? What was sort of special and new about these instruments, and how did you actually attach them to the birds without weighing them down?
Yes, it's extremely difficult to accurately measure the energetics of free living animals flying at high altitude. But we needed to custom build a data logger where we could record heart rate measurements of their electrocardiophysiology, and also measurements of their body motion using accelerometers attached to the body of the animal, and put it into a memory card and keep it there safe until the following year, because we could only catch these birds during their molt cycle in Mongolia. So we had to develop devices that had large memory and were able to record gigabytes of data. You can usually get the electronic side now to very small sizes due to all the technology developments in mobile phones. But the real problem still is making them efficient enough that you can use a small enough battery for a small bird. But for a goose-sized animal now, you can readily get a year's data from something about half the size of an AA battery.
So a goose is a really good-sized animal to do this kind of study on.
It's a fantastic size animal to work with. We got some fantastic data on wingbeat frequency and on heart rate, and also on the relationship between these two variables, which we really weren't expecting how tightly related these two were. And what we actually found is a 5% change in wingbeat frequency correlated to a 19 to 20% change in heart rate and approximately a 40% change in estimated power output of the bird. Just like with humans, so you can very accurately measure oxygen consumption, then you can relate that to heartbeat. So as the heart beats faster, it pumps the blood around faster, it transmits the oxygen from the lungs to the muscles faster and faster. So the heart rate can be calibrated to give you a measure of oxygen consumption. And if we compared that heart rate with the wingbeat frequency, in effect, we were seeing that they were calibrating each other. So wingbeat frequency was very closely related, in our view, to overall power. But the wingbeat frequency is only one component of the wing cycle, because the other important one is how far the wing moves during the wing beat. And what we see from the geese is that as the wing accelerates, it also beats further and deeper. So it travels further on each beat, even though each cycle is going faster and faster. It's like cycling with an ever bigger cog on your pedal on your bike and a small cog on the back wheel. And as you drive the bigger cog around with the pedals, it's very, very hard. You're having to travel further because of the number of extra teeth you have in the cog. And this is spinning the back wheel around faster and faster, even though it's extremely hard work for you to do it, of course. The same thing is happening. As the wing beat changes just a small amount, the heart rate is having to go up a much larger amount. So it's an exponential relationship.
And tell me a little bit more about this unexpected roller coaster strategy that you found. What are the energetic costs and benefits of it?
Well, the problem with flying high is that the air has become less dense. And that means that the wing, which is trying to get force transmitted to the air, is struggling to get the lift it requires to support its weight and the thrust it requires to speed the animal forward through the air. So as it gets higher, it has to beat the wing faster, which is costing it more energy, and it's becoming more and more difficult to fly. At the same time, the amount of oxygen in the air is decreasing due to the atmospheric pressure declining. And so at 5,500 meters, the atmospheric pressure is half what it is at sea level. At the top of Everest, it makes you feel like you're only breathing 7% oxygen if you're at sea level. So they've got these two huge problems to overcome as they go higher into the air. So the roller coaster strategy, and what we believe is happening, is that they go down because, of course, the denser air is to be found at the lowest possible altitude. If they were to go up and maintain a steady high altitude, say they were to fly up to 6,000, 7,000 meters and just fly along at that level, they're spending an awful lot of time at a very difficult high energy flight. So the cost of actually just flying horizontally at high altitude is so dominant to the overall cost of the journey that actually it's cheaper to descend, reduce the overall costs of flying. Obviously, descending is easy for them, but then they're flying along most of the time at much lower altitude in higher denser air. It's easier to get the oxygen. It's easier to generate the lift and the thrust that they need to keep flying. And then occasionally, of course, they'll have to climb back up over another obstacle and another ridge. But even if you add in the extra costs of having to climb back up again, the overall cost is less than if they'd done the journey at a higher constant altitude. So the roller coaster strategy turns out to be very sensible. They reduce their costs by just keeping to the ground, tracking the terrain as well as they can. Other things that we see that they're doing is that sometimes they get caught in updrafts of air, and this will be helping it in two ways. One, it could increase its rate of climb, or it could decrease its cost of just flying horizontally. But we captured quite big events just occasionally where the bird would suddenly almost triple its rate of climb with no increase in heart rate. And in some cases, we actually saw the heart rate decrease as if it was able to completely throttle back flying. So that was one of the things. The other thing we think they might be doing is they could be flying in what are called V-formation flights. And this is where they could gain lift assistance from the bird in front, from the vortices and the wind coming off the wingtips of the bird in front. But we have no idea whether this is actually being used much by these birds, although we know that they're capable of doing it.
Well, it sounds like you've gotten some unprecedented data. Now, do you plan on using these instruments to answer other questions about barheaded geese or other species? What sort of birding questions are waiting to be tackled out there?
Well, I'd very much like to go back and do more work on the barheaded geese, because I think we've only just begun to see the details of their strategy, and we really would like to link it in with weather data, the influence of wind direction and wing strength. Demoiselle cranes also do this migration. If so, I'd very much like to study the cranes, because although it's a similar route, they do it in a different way. So that would be fascinating. And then, of course, the vast majority of birds are actually very small. So it would be fascinating to get some of this kind of information from much smaller species.
Now, is there any way for us to imagine what it must be like to have the metabolism of a bird?
Well, I imagine it actually feel fantastic. Birds can outperform us athletically, and one of the reasons is that the average bird has a heart that's twice the size of an average mammal. So you could imagine that you can run almost twice as fast. You could probably perform at much higher altitude without a loss of performance. And in the particular case of the barheaded geese, they can perform at 5,000 meters pretty much the same as they can perform at sea level.
That's the only superpower I've ever thought I'd really want, is to be able to fly. So.
Yes, it would be handy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it would be a lot of fun.
So we know that birds are very superior in terms of their ability to cope with low-density air and low-oxygen atmospheres and low pressure. This is another very important thing. So when a human climbs in the mountains, we know that acute mountain sickness can kick in from 3,000 meters upwards, and you have to acclimatize and spend many weeks, and even then you could get sick. But these birds went from India over the Himalayas in a single flight, in some cases within 6 or 7 hours. they didn't need any acclimatization. The other thing I should say about migrant birds is they don't appear to do any training. They just go on fly for hours at a time, days at a time in some cases. Now people are understanding the genes involved in muscle fitness, that in fact, just like these animals, it would be possible to target those genes and actually allow humans to develop fitness without actually having to train so hard. And maybe something similar could occur with acute mountain sickness if we understand the genetic controls that allow these animals to cope so easily with an environment that we struggle in.
Charles, thanks for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Charles Bishop and colleagues write about the energetics of high-altitude flight this week in Science.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other places on the web, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.